We have a customer. Kemp squinted his crusted eyes. The war will wait, he said. Dane looked more closely at the boy. God, he's beautiful. I hope they take good care of him. Corporal, you may think that he wants to bear arms against a foe, but I think he's running away from love. Kemp was relieved that the sergeant wasn't quite sober. You think some dame hurt him? He played any game his sergeant wished. You think it's a foreign legion? Maybe he's running away from himself. Kemp said, I saw that picture. There's one mean son of a bitch of a sergeant in it. I don't believe it, said Dane. Step up, young man. 18, aren't you?
Yes, sir.
Dane turned to his man. What do you think?
Hell, said Kemp. I say if they're big enough, they're old enough.
The sergeant said, Let's say you're 18, and we'll stick to it, shall we?
Yes, sir.
You just take this form and fill it out. Now you figure out what year you were born, and you put it down right here, and you remember it. Chapter 50. Joe didn't like for Kate to sit still and stare straight ahead, hour after hour. That meant she was thinking. And since her face had no expression, Joe had no access to her thoughts. It made him uneasy. He didn't want his first real good break to get away from him. He had only one plan himself, and that was to keep her stirred up until she gave herself away. Then he could jump in any direction. But how about it if she sat looking at the wall? Was she stirred up or wasn't she? Joe knew she hadn't been to bed, and when he asked her whether or not she wanted breakfast, she shook her head so slowly that it was hard to know whether she had heard him or not. He advised himself cautiously, Don't do nothing. Just stick around and keep your eyes and ears open. The girls in the house knew something had happened, but no two of them had the same story, the goddamn chickenheads. Kate was not thinking. Her mind drifted among impressions, the way a bat drifts and swoops in the evening. She saw the face of the blonde and beautiful boy, his eyes mad with shock. She heard his ugly words aimed not so much at her as at himself, and she saw his dark brother leaning against the door and laughing. Kate had laughed, too, the quickest and best self-protection. What would her son do? What had he done after he went quietly away? She thought of Cal's eyes, with their look of sluggish and fulfilled cruelty, peering at her as he slowly closed the door. Why had he brought his brother? What did he want? What was he after? If she knew, she could take care of herself, but she didn't know. The pain was creeping in her hands again, and there was a new place. Her right hip ached angrily when she moved. She thought, so the pain will move in toward the center, and sooner or later all the pains will meet in the center and join like rats in a clot. In spite of his advice to himself, Joe couldn't let it alone. He carried a pot of tea to her door, knocked softly, opened the door, and went in. As far as he could see, she hadn't moved. He said, I brought you some tea, ma'am.
Put it on the table, she said. And then, as a second thought, Thank you, Joe.
You don't feel good, ma'am?
The pain's back. The medicine fooled me.
Anything I can do?
She raised her hands. Cut these off, at the wrists. She grimaced with the extra pain lifting her hands had caused. Makes you feel hopeless, she said plaintively.
Joe had never heard a tone of weakness in her before, and his instinct told him it was time to move in. He said, Maybe you don't want me to bother you, but I got some word about that other. He knew by the little interval before she answered that she had tensed.
What other? She asked softly.
That dame, ma'am.
Oh, you mean Ethel? Yes, ma'am.
I'm getting tired of Ethel. What is it now?
Well, I'll tell you like it happened. I can't make nothing out of it. I'm in Kellogg's cigar store, and a fella come up to me. You're Joe, he says, and I tell him, who says? You was looking for somebody, he says. Tell me about it, I says. Never seen the guy before. So he says, that party told me she wants to talk to you. And I told him, well, why don't she? He gives me the long look, and he says, maybe you forgot what the judge said. I guess he means about her coming back.
He looked at Kate's face, still and pale, the eyes looking straight ahead. Kate said, and then he asked you for some money?
No, ma'am, he didn't. He says something don't make no sense. He says, does Faye mean anything to you? Not a thing, I told him. He says, maybe you better talk to her. Maybe, I says, and I come away. Don't make no sense to me. I figured I'd ask you.
Kate said, does the name Faye mean anything to you?
Not a thing.
Her voice became very soft. You mean you never heard that Faye used to own this house?
Joe felt a sickening jolt in the pit of his stomach. What a goddamn fool. Couldn't keep his mouth shut. His mind floundered. Why, come to think of it, I believe I did hear that. Seemed like the name was like Faith.
The sudden alarm was good for Kate. It took the blonde head and the pain from her. It gave her something to do. She responded to the challenge with something like pleasure. She laughed softly. Faith, she said under her breath. Pour me some tea, Joe. She didn't appear to notice that his hand shook and that the teapot spout rattled against the cup. She didn't look at him even when he set the cup before her and then stepped back out of range of her eyes. Joe was quaking with apprehension. Kate said in a pleading voice, Joe, do you think you could help me? If I gave you $10,000, do you think you could fix everything up? She waited just a second, then swung around and looked full in his face. His eyes were moist. She caught him licking his lips. And at her sudden move, he stepped back as though she had struck at him. Her eyes wouldn't let him go. Did I catch you out, Joe?
I don't know what you're getting at, ma'am.
You go and figure it out, and then you come and tell me. You're good at figuring things out. And send Therese in, will you? He wanted to get out of this room where he was outpointed and outfought. He'd made a mess of things. He wondered if he'd bollocksed up the brakes. And then the bitch had the nerve to say, thank you for bringing tea. You're a nice boy. He wanted to slam the door, but he didn't dare. Kate got up stiffly, trying to avoid the pain of moving her hip. She went to her desk and slipped out a sheet of paper. Holding the pen was difficult. She wrote, moving her whole arm, Dear Ralph, tell the sheriff it wouldn't do any harm to check on Joe Valerie's fingerprints. You remember Joe. He works for me. Yours, Kate. She was folding the paper when Therese came in, looking frightened.
You want me? Did I do something? I tried my best, ma'am. I ain't been well.
Come here, Kate said. And while the girl waited beside the desk, Kate slowly addressed the envelope and stamped it. I want you to run a little errand for me, she said. Go to Bell's Candy Store and get a 5-pound box of mixed chocolates and a 1-pound box. The big one is for you girls. Stop at Crow's Drugstore and get me 2 medium toothbrushes and a can of tooth powder. You know, that can with a spout?
Yes, ma'am.
Therese was greatly relieved. You're a good girl, Kate went on. I've had my eye on you. I'm not well, Therese. If I see that you do this well, I'll seriously consider putting you in charge when I go to the hospital.
You will... Are you going to the hospital?
I don't know yet, dear, but I'll need your help. Now, here's some money for the candy.
Medium toothbrushes, remember.
Yes, ma'am, thank you. Shall I go now?
Yes, and kind of creep out, will you? Don't let the other girls know what I told you.
I'll go out the back way.
She hurried toward the door. Kate said, I nearly forgot. Will you drop this in a mailbox?
Sure I will, ma'am. Sure I will. Anything else?
That's all, dear. When the girl was gone, Kate rested her arms and hands on the desk so that each crooked finger was supported. Here it was. Maybe she had always known. She must have, but there was no need to think of that now. She would come back to that. They would put Joe away, but there'd be someone else. And there was always Ethel. Sooner or later, sooner or later. But no need to think about that now. She tiptoed her mind around the whole subject and back to an elusive thing that peeped out and then withdrew. It was when she had been thinking of her yellow-haired son that the fragment had first come to her mind. His face, hurt, bewildered, despairing, had brought it. Then she remembered. She was a very small girl with a face as lovely and fresh as her son's face. A very small girl. Most of the time she knew she was smarter and prettier than anyone else. But now and then a lonely fear would fall upon her, so that she seemed surrounded by a tree-tall forest of enemies. Then every thought and word and look was aimed to hurt her, and she had no place to run and no place to hide. And she would cry in panic because there was no escape and no sanctuary. Then one day she was reading a book. She could read when she was 5 years old. She remembered the book, brown with a silver title, and the cloth was broken and the boards thick. It was Alice in Wonderland. Kate moved her hands slowly and lifted her weight a little from her arms. And she could see the drawings. Alice with long straight hair. But it was the bottle which said, drink me, that had changed her life. Alice had taught her that. When the forest of her enemies surrounded her, she was prepared. In her pocket she had a bottle of sugar water, and on its red-framed label she had written, drink me. She would take a sip from the bottle, and she would grow smaller and smaller. Let her enemies look for her then. Kathy would be under a leaf, or looking out of an anthole, laughing. They couldn't find her then. No door could close her out, and no door could close her in. She could walk upright under a door. And always there was Alice to play with, Alice to love her and trust her. Alice was her friend, always waiting to welcome her to tininess. All this so good that it was almost worthwhile to be miserable. But good as it was, there was one more thing always held in reserve. It was her threat and her safety. She had only to drink the whole bottle, and she would dwindle and disappear and cease to exist. And better than all, when she stopped being, she never would have been. This was her darling safety. Sometimes in her bed she would drink enough of drink me so that she was a dot as small as the littlest gnat. But she had never gone clear out, never had to. That was her reserve, guarded from everyone. Kate shook her head sadly, remembering the cut-off little girl. She wondered why she had forgotten that wonderful trick. It had saved her from so many disasters. The light filtering down at one through a clover leaf was glorious. Kathy and Alice walked among towering grass, arms around each other, best friends. And Kathy never had to drink all of Drink Me because she had Alice.
This ends Disc 20. East of Eden, Disc 21.
Kate put her head down on the blotter between her crooked hands. She was cold and desolate. Alone and desolate. Whatever she had done, she had been driven to do. She was different. She had something more than other people. She raised her head and made no move to wipe her streaming eyes. That was true. She was smarter and stronger than other people. She had something they lacked.
And right in the middle of her thought, Cal's dark face hung in the air in front of her, and his lips were smiling with cruelty. The weight pressed down on her, forcing her breath out. They had something she lacked, and she didn't know what it was. Once she knew this, she was ready. And once ready, she knew she had been ready for a long time, perhaps all of her life. Her mind functioned like a wooden mind. Her body moved crookedly like a badly operated marionette, but she went steadily about her business. It was noon. She knew from the chatter of the girls in the dining room. The slugs had only just got up. Kate had trouble with the doorknob and turned it finally by rolling it between her palms. The girls choked in the middle of laughter and looked up at her. The cook came in from the kitchen. Kate was a sick ghost, crooked and in some way horrible. She leaned against the dining room wall and smiled at her girls, and her smile frightened them even more, for it was like the frame for a scream. "Where's Joe?" Kate asked.
"He went out, ma'am."
"Listen," she said. "I've had no sleep for a long time. I'm going to take some medicine and sleep. I don't want to be disturbed. I don't want any supper. I'll sleep the clock around. Tell Joe I don't want anybody to come near me for anything until tomorrow morning. Do you understand?"
"Yes, ma'am," they said.
"Good night, then. It's afternoon, but I mean good night."
"Good night, ma'am,"
they chorused obediently. Kate turned and walked crabwise back to her room. She closed her door and stood looking around, trying to form her simple procedure. She went back to her desk. This time she forced her hand, in spite of the pain, to write plainly, "I leave everything I have to my son, Aaron Trask." She dated the sheet and signed it, "Catherine Trask." Her fingers dwelt on the page, and then she got up and left her will face upward on the desk. At the center table, she poured cold tea into her cup and carried the cup to the gray room in the lean-to and set it on the reading table. Then she went to her dressing table and combed her hair, rubbed a little rouge all over her face, covered it lightly with powder, and put on the pale lipstick she always used. Last, she filed her nails and cleaned them. When she closed the door to the gray room, the outside light was cut off, and only the reading lamp threw its cone on the table. She arranged the pillows, patted them up, and sat down. She leaned her head experimentally against the down pillow. She felt rather gay, as though she were going to a party. Gingerly, she fished the chain out from her bodice, unscrewed the little tube, and shook the capsule into her hand. She smiled at it.
"Eat me,"
she said, and put the capsule in her mouth. She picked up the teacup.
"Drink me,"
she said, and swallowed the bitter cold tea. She forced her mind to stay on Alice, so tiny and waiting. Other faces peered in from the sides of her eyes, her father and mother, and Charles, and Adam, and Samuel Hamilton, and then Aaron, and she could see Cal smiling at her. He didn't have to speak. The glint of his eyes said, "You missed something. They had something, and you missed it." She thrust her mind back to Alice. In the gray wall opposite, there was a nail hole. Alice would be in there, and she would put her arm around Kathy's waist, and Kathy would put her arm around Alice's waist, and they would walk away, best friends, and tiny as the head of a pin. A warm numbness began to creep into her arms and legs. The pain was going from her hands. Her eyelids felt heavy, very heavy. She yawned. She thought, or said, or thought, "Alice doesn't know. I'm going right on past." Her eyes closed and a dizzy nausea shook her. She opened her eyes and stared about in terror. The gray room darkened, and the cone of light flowed and rippled like water. And then her eyes closed again, and her fingers curled as though they held small breasts. And then her heart beat solemnly, and her breathing slowed as she grew smaller and smaller, and then disappeared. And she had never been. When Kate dismissed him, Joe went to the barber shop, as he always did when he was upset. He had his hair cut and an egg shampoo and tonic. He had a facial massage and a mud pack, and around the edges he had his nails manicured, and he had his shoes shined. Ordinarily this and a new necktie set Joe up, but he was still depressed when he left the barber with a 50-cent tip. Kate had trapped him like a rat, caught him with his pants down. Her fast thinking left him confused and helpless. The trick she had of leaving it to you whether she meant anything or not was no less confusing. The night started dully, but then 16 members and 2 pledges from Sigma Alpha Epsilon, Stanford chapter, came in hilarious from a pledge hazing in San Juan. They were full of horseplay. Florence, who smoked the cigarette in the circus, had a hard cough. Every time she tried, she coughed and lost it. And the pony stallion had diarrhea. The college boys shrieked and pounded each other in their amusement, and then they stole everything that wasn't nailed down. After they had left, 2 of the girls got into a tired and monotonous quarrel, and Therese turned up with the first symptoms of the old Joe. Oh, Christ, what a night. And down the hall, that brooding, dangerous thing was silent behind its closed door. Joe stood by the door before he went to bed, and he could hear nothing. He closed the house at 2:30 and was in bed by 3, but he couldn't sleep. He sat up in bed and read 7 chapters of The Winning of Barbara Worth, and when it was daylight, he went down to the silent kitchen and made a pot of coffee. He rested his elbows on the table and held the coffee mug with both hands. Something had gone wrong, and Joe couldn't figure out what it was. Maybe she'd found out that Ethel was dead. He'd have to watch his step. And then he made up his mind and made it up firmly. He would go in to see her at 9, and he'd keep his ears open. Maybe he hadn't heard right. Best thing would be to lay it on the line and not be a hog. Just say he'd take $1,000 and get the hell out. And if she said no, he'd get the hell out anyway. He was sick of working with dames. He could get a job dealing faro and Reno, regular hours, and no dames. Maybe get himself an apartment and fix it up. Big chairs and a Davenport. No point in beating his brains out in this lousy town. Better if he got out of the state anyway. He considered going right now. Just get up from this table, climb the stairs, 2 minutes to pack a suitcase and gone. 3 or 4 minutes at the most. Don't tell nobody nothing. The idea appealed to him. The breaks about Ethel might not be as good as he thought at first, but $1,000 was a stake. Better wait. When the cook came in, he was in a bad mood. He had a developing carbuncle on the back of his neck, and the skin from the inside of an eggshell stretched over it to draw it to a head. He didn't want anybody in his kitchen feeling the way he did. Joe went back to his room and read some more, and then he packed his suitcase. He was going to get out any way it went. At 9 o'clock, he knocked gently on Kate's door and pushed it open. Her bed hadn't been slept in. He set down the tray and went to the door of the lean-to and knocked again, and then called. Finally, he opened the door. The cone of light fell on the reading stand. Kate's head was deeply cushioned in the pillow. "You must have slept all night here," Joe said. He walked around in front of her, saw bloodless lips and eyes shining dully between half-closed lids, and he knew she was dead. He moved his head from side to side and went quickly into the other room to make sure that the door to the hall was closed. With great speed, he went through the dresser, drawer by drawer, opened her purses, the little box by her bed, and he stood still. She didn't have a goddamn thing, not even a silver-backed hairbrush. He crept to the lean-to and stood in front of her. Not a ring, not a pin. Then he saw the little chain around her neck and lifted it clear and unsnapped the clasp. A small gold watch, a little tube, and two safe deposit keys, number 27 and 29. "So that's where you got it, you bitch," he said. He slipped the watch off the thin chain and put it in his pocket. He wanted to punch her in the nose. Then he thought of her desk. The two-line holograph will attracted him. Somebody might pay for that. He put it in his pocket. He took a handful of papers from a pigeonhole, bills and receipts. Next hole, insurance. Next, a small book with records of every girl. He put that in his pocket, too. He took the rubber band from a packet of brown envelopes, opened one, and pulled out a photograph. On the back of the picture, in Kate's neat, sharp handwriting, a name, an address, and a title. Joe laughed aloud. This was the real breaks. He tried another envelope, and another. A gold mine. Guy could live for years on these. Look at that fat-ass councilman. He put the band back. In the top drawer, $8 $10 bills and a bunch of keys. He pocketed the money, too. As he opened the second drawer enough to see that it held writing paper and sealing wax and ink, there was a knock on the door. He walked to it and opened it a crack. The cook said, "Fella out here wants to see you." "Who is he?" "How the hell do I know?" Joe looked back at the room and then stepped out, took the key from the inside, locked the door, and put the key in his pocket. He might have overlooked something. Oscar Noble was standing in the big front room, his gray hat on his head and his red Mackinaw buttoned up tight around his throat. His eyes were pale gray, the same color as his stubble whiskers. The room was in semi-darkness. No one had raised the shades yet. Joe came lightly along the hall, and Oscar asked, "You Joe?"
"Who's asking?"
"The sheriff wants to have a talk with you." Joe felt ice creeping into his stomach.
"Pinch?" he asked. "Got a warrant?"
"Hell no," said Oscar. "We got nothing on you, just checking up. Will you come along?"
"Sure," said Joe. "Why not?"
They went out together. Joe shivered.
"I should have got a coat."
"Want to go back for one?"
"I guess not," said Joe.
They walked toward Castroville Street. Oscar asked, "Ever been mugged or printed?" Joe was quiet for a time.
"Yes," he said at last.
"What for?"
"Drunk," said Joe. "Hit a cop."
"Well, we'll soon find out," said Oscar, and turned the corner. Joe ran like a rabbit, across the street and over the track toward the stores and alleys of Chinatown. Oscar had to take a glove off and unbutton his Mackinaw to get his gun out. He tried a snap shot and missed. Joe began to zigzag. He was 50 yards away by now and nearing an opening between two buildings. Oscar stepped to a telephone pole at the curb, braced his left elbow against it, gripped his right wrist with his left hand, and drew a bead on the entrance to the little alley. He fired just as Joe touched the front sight. Joe splashed forward on his face and skidded a foot. Oscar went into a Filipino pool room to phone, and when he came out, there was quite a crowd around the body. Chapter 51. In 1903, Horace Quinn beat Mr. R. Keefe for the office of sheriff. He had been well trained as the chief deputy sheriff.
Most of the voters figured that since Quinn was doing most of the work, he might as well have the title. Sheriff Quinn held the office until 1919. He was sheriff so long that we growing up in Monterey County thought the words sheriff and Quinn went together naturally. We couldn't imagine anyone else being sheriff. Quinn grew old in his office. He limped from an early injury. We knew he was intrepid, for he had held his own in various gunfights. Besides, he looked like a sheriff, the only kind we knew about. His face was broad and pink, his white mustache shaped like the horns of a longhorn steer. He was broad of shoulder, and in his age, he developed a portliness which only gave him more authority. He wore a fine Stetson hat, a Norfolk jacket, and in his later years carried his gun and a shoulder holster. His old belt holster tugged at his stomach too much. He had known his county in 1903, and he knew it and controlled it even better in 1917. He was an institution, as much a part of the Salinas Valley as its mountains. In all the years since Adams' shooting, Sheriff Quinn had kept track of Kate. When Faye died, he knew instinctively that Kate was probably responsible. But he also knew he hadn't much of any chance of convicting her, and a wise sheriff doesn't butt his head against the impossible. They were only a couple of whores, after all. In the years that followed, Kate played fair with him, and he gradually achieved a certain respect for her. Since there were going to be houses anyway, they had better be run by responsible people. Every so often, Kate spotted a wanted man and turned him in. She ran a house which didn't get into trouble. Sheriff Quinn and Kate got along together. The Saturday after Thanksgiving, about noon, Sheriff Quinn looked through the papers from Joe Valerie's pockets. The .38 caliber slug had splashed off one side of Joe's heart and had flattened against the ribs and tore out a section as big as a fist. The manila envelopes were glued together with blackened blood. The sheriff dampened the papers with a wet handkerchief to get them apart. He read the will, which had been folded so that the blood was on the outside. He laid it aside and inspected the photographs in the envelopes. He sighed deeply. Every envelope contained a man's honor and peace of mind. Effectively used, these pictures could cause half a dozen suicides. Already Kate was on the table at Muller's with the formalin running into her veins, and her stomach was in a jar in the coroner's office. When he had seen all of the pictures, he called a number. He said into the phone, "Can you drop over to my office?" "Well, put your lunch off, will you?" "Yes, I think you'll see it's important. I'll wait for you." A few minutes later, when the nameless man stood beside his desk in the front office of the old red county jail behind the courthouse, Sheriff Quinn stuck the will out in front of him. "As a lawyer, would you say this is any good?" His visitor read the two lines and breathed deep through his nose. "Is this who I think it is?" "Yes." "Well, if her name was Catherine Trask, and this is her handwriting, and if Aaron Trask is her son, this is as good as gold." Quinn lifted the ends of his fine, wide mustache with the back of his forefinger. "You knew her, didn't you?" "Well, not to say no, I knew who she was." Quinn put his elbows on his desk and leaned forward. "Sit down. I want to talk to you." His visitor drew up a chair. His fingers picked at a coat button. The sheriff asked, "Was Kate blackmailing you?"
"Certainly not. Why should she?"
"I'm asking you as a friend. You know she's dead. You can tell me."
"I don't know what you're getting at. Nobody's blackmailing me."
Quinn slipped a photograph from its envelope, turned it like a playing card, and skidded it across the desk. His visitor adjusted his glasses, and the breath whistled in his nose.
"Jesus Christ," he said softly.
"You didn't know she had it?"
"Oh, I knew it, all right. She let me know." "For Christ's sake, Horace, what are you going to do with this?"
Quinn took the picture from his hand.
"Horace, what are you going to do with it?"
"Burn it." The sheriff ruffled the edges of the envelopes with his thumb. "Here's a deck of hell," he said. "These could tear the county to pieces." Quinn wrote a list of names on a sheet of paper. Then he hoisted himself up on his game leg and went to the iron stove against the north wall of his office. He crunched up the Salinas Morning Journal and lighted it and dropped it in the stove. And when it flared up, he dropped the manila envelopes on the flame, set the damper, and closed the stove. The fire roared, and the flames winked yellow behind the little isinglass windows in the front of the stove. Quinn brushed his hands together as though they were dirty. "The negatives were in there," he said. "I've been through her desk. There weren't any other prints." His visitor tried to speak, but his voice was a husky whisper. "Thank you, Horace." The sheriff gimped to his desk and picked up his list. "I want you to do something for me. Here's a list. Tell everyone on this list I've burned the pictures. You know them all, God knows. And they could take it from you. Nobody's holy. Get each man alone and tell him exactly what happened. Look here." He opened the stove door and poked the black sheets until they were reduced to powder. "Tell them that," he said. His visitor looked at the sheriff, and Quinn knew that there was no power on earth that could keep this man from hating him. For the rest of their lives, there'd be a barrier between them, and neither one could ever admit it.
"Horace, I don't know how to thank you."
And the sheriff said in sorrow, "That's all right. It's what I'd want my friends to do for me."
"The goddamn bitch,"
his visitor said softly. And Horace Quinn knew that part of the curse was for him. And he knew he wouldn't be sheriff much longer. These guilt-feeling men could get him out, and they would have to. He sighed and sat down. "Go to your lunch now," he said. "I got work to do." At 1:15, Sheriff Quinn turned off Main Street on Central Avenue. At Renault's Bakery, he bought a loaf of French bread, still warm and giving off its wonderful smell of fermented dough. He used the handrail to help himself up the steps of the Trask porch. Lee answered the door, a dish towel tied around his middle.
"He's not home," he said.
"Well, he's on his way. I called the draft board. I'll wait for him." Lee moved aside and let him in and seated him in the living room.
"You like a nice cup of hot coffee?" he asked.
"I don't mind if I do."
"Fresh made," said Lee, and went into the kitchen.
Quinn looked around the comfortable sitting room. He felt that he didn't want his office much longer. He remembered hearing a doctor say, "I love to deliver a baby because if I do my work well, there's joy at the end of it." The sheriff had thought often of that remark. It seemed to him that if he did his work well, there was sorrow at the end of it for somebody. The fact that it was necessary was losing its weight with him. He'd be retiring soon, whether he wanted to or not. Every man has a retirement picture in which he does those things he never had time to do. Makes the journeys, reads the neglected books he always pretended to have read. For many years, the sheriff dreamed of spending the shining time hunting and fishing, wandering in the Santa Lucia Range, camping by half-remembered streams. And now that it was almost time, he knew he didn't want to do it. Sleeping on the ground would make his leg ache. He remembered how heavy a deer is, and how hard it is to carry the dangling, limp body from the place of the kill. And frankly, he didn't care for venison anyway. Madame Renault could soak it in wine and lace it with spice, but hell, an old shoe would taste good with that treatment. Lee had bought a percolator. Quinn could hear the water spluttering against the glass dome, and his long-trained mind made the suggestion that Lee hadn't told the truth about having fresh-made coffee. It was a good mind the old man had, sharpened in its work. He could bring up whole faces in his mind and inspect them, and also scenes and conversations. He could play them over like a record or a film. Thinking of venison, his mind had gone about cataloging the sitting room, and his mind nudged him, saying, "Hey, there's something wrong here, something strange." The sheriff heeded the voice and looked at the room. Flowered chintz, lace curtains, white drawn-work table cover. Cushions on the couch covered with a bright and impudent print. It was a feminine room in a house where only men lived. He thought of his own sitting room. Mrs. Quinn had chosen, bought, cleaned every single thing in it, except a pipe stand. Come to think of it, she had bought the pipe stand for him. There was a woman's room, too, but this was a fake. It was too feminine. A woman's room designed by a man. And overdone, too feminine. That would be Lee. Adam wouldn't even see it, let alone put it together. No, Lee trying to make a home and Adam not even seeing it. Horace Quinn remembered questioning Adam so very long ago. Remembered him as a man in agony. He could still see Adam's haunted and horrified eyes. He had thought then of Adam as a man of such honesty that he couldn't conceive anything else. And in the years he had seen much of Adam. They both belonged to the Masonic Order. They went through the chairs together. Horace followed Adam as master of the lodge, and both of them wore their past master's pins. And Adam had been set apart. An invisible wall cut him off from the world. You couldn't get into him. He couldn't get out to you. But in that old agony, there had been no wall. In his wife, Adam had touched the living world. Horace thought of her now, gray and washed, the needles in her throat and the rubber formalin tubes hanging down from the ceiling. Adam could do no dishonesty. He didn't want anything. You had to crave something to be dishonest. The sheriff wondered what went on behind the wall. What pressures, what pleasures and achings. He shifted his behind to ease the pressure on his leg. The house was still, except for the bouncing coffee. Adam was long coming from the draft board. The amused thought came to the sheriff, "I'm getting old, and I kind of like it." Then he heard Adam at the front door. Lee heard him too and darted into the hall. "The sheriff's here," said Lee, to warn him, perhaps. Adam came in smiling and held out his hand. "Hello, Horace. Have you got a warrant?" It was a damn good try at a joke. "Howdy," Quinn said. "Your man is going to give me a cup of coffee." Lee went to the kitchen and rattled dishes. Adam said, "Anything wrong, Horace?" "Everything's always wrong in my business. I'll wait till the coffee comes." "Don't mind Lee. He listens anyway. He can hear through a closed door. I don't keep anything from him because I can't." Lee came in with a tray. He was smiling remotely to himself, and when he had poured the coffee and gone out, Adam asked again, "Is there anything wrong, Horace?" "No, I don't think so." "Adam, was that woman still married to you?" Adam became rigid. "Yes," he said. "What's the matter?" "She killed herself last night." Adam's face contorted, and his eyes swelled and glistened with tears. He fought his mouth, and then he gave up and put his face down in his hands and wept. "Oh, my poor darling," he said. Quinn sat quietly and let him have it out. And after a time, Adam's control came back, and he raised his head. "Excuse me, Horace," he said. Lee came in from the kitchen and put a damp towel in his hands, and Adam sponged his eyes and handed it back. "I didn't expect that," Adam said, and his face was ashamed. "What shall I do? I'll claim her. I'll bury her." "I wouldn't," said Horace. "That is, unless you feel you have to. That's not what I came about." He took the folded will from his pocket and held it out. Adam shrank from it.
Is that her blood?
No, it's not. It's not her blood at all. Read it. Adam read the two lines and went right on staring at the paper and beyond it.
He doesn't know. She's his mother.
You never told him?
No.
Jesus Christ, said the sheriff. Adam said earnestly, I'm sure he wouldn't want anything of hers. Let's just tear it up and forget it. If he knew, I don't think Aaron would want anything of hers.
Afraid you can't, Quinn said. We do quite a few illegal things. She had a safe deposit box. I don't have to tell you where I got the will or the key. I went to the bank. Didn't wait for a court order. Thought it might have a bearing. He didn't tell Adam he thought there might be more pictures. Well, old Bob let me open the box. We can always deny it. There's over $100,000 in gold certificates. There's money in there in bales. And there isn't one goddamn thing in there but money.
Nothing?
One other thing. A marriage certificate.
Adam leaned back in his chair. The remoteness was coming down again, the soft, protective folds between himself and the world. He saw his coffee and took a sip of it.
What do you think I ought to do?
He asked steadily and quietly.
I can only tell you what I'd do, Shura Quinn said. You don't have to take my advice. I'd have the boy in right now. I'd tell him everything, every single thing. I'd even tell him why you didn't tell him before. He's how old?
17.
He's a man. He's got to take it sometime. Better if he gets the whole thing at once.
Cal knows, said Adam. I wonder why she made the will to Aaron.
God knows. Well, what do you think?
I don't know.
And so I'm going to do what you say. Will you stay with me?
Sure I will. Lee,
Adam called.
Tell Aaron I want him. He has come home, hasn't he?
Lee came to the doorway. His heavy lids closed for a moment and then opened.
Not yet. Maybe he went back to school.
He would have told me. You know, Horace, we drank a lot of champagne on Thanksgiving.
Where's Cal?
In his room, said Lee.
Well, call him. Get him in. Cal will know.
Cal's face was tired, and his shoulders sagged with exhaustion. But his face was pinched and closed and crafty and mean. Adam asked,
Do you know where your brother is?
No, I don't, said Cal.
Weren't you with him at all?
No.
He hasn't been home for 2 nights. Where is he?
How do I know? Said Cal. Am I supposed to look after him?
Adam's head sank down, his body jarred, just a little quiver. In back of his eyes, a tiny, sharp, incredibly bright blue light flashed. He said thickly,
Maybe he did go back to college.
His lips seemed heavy, and he murmured like a man talking in his sleep.
Don't you think he went back to college?
Sheriff Quinn stood up.
Anything I gotta do, I can do later. You get a rest, Adam. You've had a shock.
Adam looked up at him.
Shock? Oh, yes. Thank you, George. Thank you very much.
George?
Thank you very much, said Adam.
When the sheriff had gone, Cal went to his room. Adam leaned back in his chair, and very soon he went to sleep, and his mouth dropped open, and he snored across his pallet. Lee watched him for a while before he went back to his kitchen. He lifted the bread box and took out a tiny volume bound in leather, and the gold tooling was almost completely worn away. The Meditations of Marcus Aurelius, in English translation. Lee wiped his steel-rimmed spectacles on a dish towel. He opened the book and leafed through, and he smiled to himself, consciously searching for reassurance.
He read slowly, moving his lips over the words. Everything is only for a day, both that which remembers and that which is remembered. Observe constantly that all things take place by change, and accustom thyself to consider that the nature of the universe loves nothing so much as to change things which are, and to make new things like them. For everything that exists is in a manner the seed of that which will be. Lee glanced down the page. Thou wilt die soon, and thou art not yet simple, nor free from perturbations, nor without suspicion of being hurt by external things, nor kindly disposed towards all. Nor dost thou yet place wisdom only in acting justly. Lee looked up from the page, and he answered the book as he would answer one of his ancient relatives. That is true, he said. It's very hard, I'm sorry. But don't forget that you also say, always run the short way, and the short way is the natural. Don't forget that. He let the pages slip past his fingers to the flyleaf, where was written with a broad carpenter's pencil, Samuel Hamilton. Suddenly Lee felt good. He wondered whether Samuel Hamilton had ever missed his book or known who stole it. It had seemed to Lee the only clean, pure way was to steal it. And he still felt good about it. His fingers caressed the smooth leather of the binding as he took it back and slipped it under the bread box. He said to himself, but of course he knew who took it. Who else would have stolen Marcus Aurelius? He went into the sitting room and pulled a chair near to the sleeping Adam. In his room, Cal sat at his desk, elbows down, palms holding his aching head together, hands pushing against the sides of his head. His stomach churned, and the sour, sweet smell of whiskey was on him, and in him, living in his pores, in his clothing, beating sluggishly in his head. Cal had never drunk before, had never needed to. But going to Kate's had been no relief from pain, and his revenge had been no triumph. His memory was all swirling clouds and broken pieces of sound and sight and feeling. What now was true and what was imagined he couldn't separate. Coming out of Kate's, he had touched his sobbing brother, and Aaron had cut him down with a fist like a whip. Aaron had stood over him in the dark, and then suddenly turned and ran, screaming like a broken-hearted child. Cal could still hear the hoarse cries over running footsteps. Cal had lain still where he had fallen, under the tall privet in Kate's front yard. He heard the engines puffing and snorting by the roundhouse and the crash of freight cars being assembled. Then he had closed his eyes, and hearing light steps and feeling a presence, he looked up. Someone was bending over him, and he thought it was Kate. The figure moved quietly away. After a while, Cal had stood up and brushed himself and walked toward Main Street. He was surprised at how casual his feeling was. He sang softly under his breath, "There's a rose that grows in no man's land, and 'tis wonderful to see." On Friday, Cal brooded the whole day long. And in the evening, Joe Laguna bought the quart of whiskey for him. Cal was too young to purchase. Joe wanted to accompany Cal, but Joe was satisfied with the dollar Cal gave him and went back for a pint of grappa. Cal went to the alley behind the Abbott house and found the shadow behind a post where he had sat the night he first saw his mother. He sat cross-legged on the ground, and then, in spite of revulsion and nausea, he forced the whiskey into himself. Twice he vomited, and then went on drinking until the earth tipped and swayed and the streetlight spun majestically in a circle. The bottle slipped from his hand finally, and Cal passed out, but even unconscious, he still vomited weakly. A serious, short-haired dog about town with a curling tail sauntered into the alley, making his stations, but he smelled Cal and took a wide circle around him.
Joe Laguna found him and smelled him, too. Joe shook the bottle leaning against Cal's leg, and Joe held it up to the streetlight and saw that it was 1/3 full. He looked for the cork and couldn't find it. He walked away, his thumb over the neck, to keep the whiskey from sloshing out. When in the cold dawn a frost awakened Cal to a sick world, he struggled home like a broken bug. He hadn't far to go, just to the alley mouth and then across the street. Lee heard him at the door and smelled his nastiness as he bumped along the hall to his room and fell over on his bed. Cal's head shattered with pain, and he was wide awake. He had no resistance against sorrow and no device to protect himself against shame. After a while, he did the best he could. He bathed in icy water and scrubbed and scratched his body with a block of pumice stone, and the pain of his scraping seemed good to him. He knew that he had to tell his guilt to his father and beg his forgiveness, and he had to humble himself to Aaron, not only now, but always. He couldn't live without that. And yet when he was called out and stood in the room with Sheriff Quinn and his father, he was as raw and angry as a surly dog, and his hatred of himself turned outward toward everyone. A vicious cur he was, unloved, unloving. Then he was back in his room, and his guilt assaulted him, and he had no weapon to fight it off. A panic for Aaron rose in him. He might be injured, might be in trouble. It was Aaron who couldn't take care of himself. Cal knew he had to bring Aaron back, had to find him, and build him back the way he had been. And this had to be done, even though Cal sacrificed himself. And then the idea of sacrifice took hold of him, the way it does with all guilty-feeling men. A sacrifice might reach Aaron and bring him back. Cal went to his bureau and got the flat package from under his handkerchiefs in his drawer. He looked around the room and brought a porcelain pin tray to his desk. He breathed deeply and found the cool air good-tasting. He lifted one of the crisp bills, creased it in the middle so that it made an angle, and then he scratched a match under his desk and lighted the bill. The heavy paper curled and blackened. The flame ran upward. And only when the fire was about his fingertips did Cal drop the charred chip in the pin tray. He stripped off another bill and lighted it. When six were burned, Lee came in without knocking. "I smelled smoke." And then he saw what Cal was doing. "Oh," he said. Cal braced himself for intervention, but none came. Lee folded his hands across his middle, and he stood silently, waiting. Cal doggedly lighted bill after bill until all were burned. And then he crushed the black chips down to powder and waited for Lee to comment. But Lee did not speak or move. At last, Cal said,
"Go ahead. You want to talk to me. Go ahead."
"No," said Lee, "I don't. And if you have no need to talk to me, I'll stay a while, and then I'll go away. I'll sit down here." He squatted in a chair, folded his hands, and waited. He smiled to himself, the expression that is called inscrutable. Cal turned from him. "I can outsit you," he said. "In a contest, maybe," said Lee. "But in day to day, year to year, who knows? Century to century sitting? No, Cal, you'd lose." After a few minutes, Cal said peevishly,
"I wish you'd get on with your lecture."
"I don't have a lecture."
"What in hell are you doing here, then? You know what I did, and I got drunk last night.
I suspect the first, and I can smell the second."
"Smell?"
"You still smell," said Lee.
"First time," said Cal. "I don't like it."
"I don't either," said Lee. "I've got a bad stomach for liquor. Besides, it makes me playful. Intellectual, but playful."
"How do you mean, Lee?"
"I can only give you an example. In my younger days, I played tennis. I liked it,